Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening and welcome to Little Atoms. Your host this week, me, Padraig Reedy, and Neil Denny. Our guest this week is Henry Nicholls. I'll hand straight over to Neil to introduce Henry.
Thanks, Padraig. Henry Nicholls is a freelance science journalist, writing regularly for Nature, New Scientist and BBC Focus, as well as the broadsheets. His first book, Lonesome George, told the story of the last giant tortoise of Pinto in the Galapagos and was shortlisted for the 2007 Royal Society General Book Prize. Henry's latest book is The Way of the Panda, The Curious History of China's Political Animal. Henry, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you very much.
Before we get onto the book, let's catch up on panda news. Let's talk about what's going on in the world of pandas. And basically, it was announced in January that there's a couple of pandas coming to Edinburgh Zoo. So tell us about what's actually happening.
A Chinese diplomatic visit to the UK, and in and amongst all these other deals, a big contract was drawn up for Edinburgh Zoo to get a pair of pandas. They're supposed to be coming in September.
Yeah. Is this a breeding pair?
That's the way that loans are now done. So a zoo will kind of approach China and then get a male and a female. Mm-hmm. And the idea is they have a long-term loan, so usually they're over the course of 10 years. And the idea is to try and breed from this pair.
There's quite a lot of money involved in these panda loans. It's renting a panda, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is really renting a panda. Yeah. I suppose the very first commercial panda loans were in the 80s, and they were there. This is period where generally referred to as this panda renting a panda, and they were done on very short term loans. So there was absolutely no attempt to breed from the animals. They were purely kind of, it was almost like a circus thing. Bring the pandas in, get the crowds, make some money. And so that was quite seedy. That was quite clearly exploitative. And more than anything, it was in contravention of the of CITES, the United Nations law against trade in endangered species, where if you're moving endangered species from one country to another, you need to demonstrate that it's for the benefit of that species. This was clearly of no benefit to pandas. It was just lining the pockets of a few people. So that eventually WWF in the States took the American Fish and Wildlife Service to court over those loans, and won, and they came to an end. And then since 1998, it's been on a sort of more ethical footing, really, with these long-term loans where there's this explicit goal, breeding goal. But you're right, there's money that changes hands, and originally, from 1998, it was $1 million per pair per year, a commitment for 10 years that these zoos, foreign zoos, were making. Mm-hmm. It's now, for most zoos, scaled down to about half that. So the going rates are now, it's now half a million dollars per pair per year.
Over the course of 10 years, I mean, that's a huge amount of money. So what's in it for Edinburgh? I mean, why would they benefit from having the pandas?
Yeah, I mean, I don't imagine anyone would share the sort of financial breakdown of these loans. But the reason it dropped from $1 million, which is what China originally demanded from San Diego Zoo in 1998, was because it was a complete loss-making venture for San Diego Zoo. They couldn't recoup that amount per year. And so at the end of their 10-year term, they basically said, well, we'd love to continue with this loan, but we just can't under this. So either you get no money or we renegotiate. So that's why it went down. I suppose $500,000 is possibly realistic to make back, and you'd do that through increased gate receipts, obviously, mm-hmm. massive sort of merchandise potential of pandas, and then sponsorship that might come. People are willing to pay a lot for pandas. So I don't know whether it's possible to make that amount of money back. Even if it isn't, it might still be worth it because of the sort of intangible kind of PR benefits of having pandas. It brings a lot of attention.
So that seems the thing between, I mean, no doubt, I mean, people, you know, zoos and so on shout quite loud, and gate receipts do go up, and you can attract sponsorship. But I thought the question, why pandas? You know, is it just because they're rare, or is there a little more to pandas in our perception of them?
They may not even be that rare. This is another controversy about pandas. I mean, one of the reasons I chose this animal as a subject was because there are so many contradictions about it. And we all think of the giant panda as you know, critically endangered. But according to the IUCN, the World Conservation Union's Red List, to qualify for that, there are various criteria that you need to meet. And the one that the panda falls under, the one that qualifies it for endangered status, is that there are fewer than 2,500 wild pandas.
Mm-hmm. But we don't know if that's
We certainly that's don't true. Know if that's the case. And there's at least one study. It didn't go down very well with everyone.
With the all-powerful panda lobby.
With all the all-powerful panda lobby, or possibly the World Wildlife Fund, suggested there were more than that. Now, if that were the case, if China somehow did a survey, they're incredibly difficult to survey, so you've got to give them that credit. We just don't know. But if it turned out there were more than 2,500, it would require downlisting the panda from endangered to vulnerable, which just isn't, you know, that's a bit cynical to say, but it isn't quite such a marketing
ploy. It's not quite as sexy, is it?
No. So, I mean, the endangered status, the perceived endangered status of the panda is very important. But, of course, it's not too pushing it too much to say that they are just stunning. I mean, that's obviously the thing that they really have going for them. And I'm fairly dispassionate about pandas, and strange to say, but whenever I see a panda, I've tried to sort of approach it in a very kind of skeptical approach to the panda, and just surprised at my kind of very, very innate and slightly pathetic response to what is just a very, very cute animal. They just pull people in. So back in 1966, there was a great book written by Desmond Morris. It was before he did The Naked Ape, and his wife Ramona, who's a historian, and they pulled together pretty much everything that was then known about pandas. And at the end, Desmond Morris has this chapter where he comes up with 20 reasons why the panda is just such a crowd pleaser. And they're things like baby-like body proportions, flattish face. These are things that appeal. Large appearance of these large eyes. Very playful, slightly clumsy as well. So, you know, if a panda climbs up a tree and then falls out of it, that's very endearing. So there are all those things, and they you know, even if there's not a lot of science behind that kind of explanation, I don't think very many people would question it. It makes a lot of sense that those things are the sorts of things that appeal to the anthropocentrically gullible. And so there's that. But what I've tried to do, I think, in my book is add a bit to that. And I think the twists and turns of history have also kind of contributed a bit. So I do wonder if the panda had been elsewhere and discovered at a different point in time, whether it would have quite the same appeal right now.
Well, the book is full of, you said, is full of, you know, various sort of contradictions and astonishing facts. And the first one, really, that we've come across in the book is this idea that, you know, the panda is a really recent discovery in terms of, you know, and we're not even really necessarily talking about, you know, I'm doing inverted commas, which you can't see, but Western science going over and discovering it. I mean, there seems to be hardly any record of pandas in Chinese history either.
That's right. I mean, every other author I read, and there's an awful lot written about pandas, but all the panda books that I digested, they all cite this wonderful story about the panda appearing in ancient Chinese literature. And ancient Chinese, or kind of imperial Chinese, references to natural history are very different from Western views of nature, and they're not literal in the same sense. So there may be aspects of pandas in some of these mythical creatures that are talked about in, say, 16th century texts or even further back, 2,000 years. I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case, but they're just not literal biological descriptions. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, what really surprises me still, and I have looked and a lot of other people have looked, there's no artistic rendition of the giant panda in Chinese art. You know, the Chinese very, very rich tradition of painting natural history and biologically quite accurate natural history. So even if the texts aren't doing that literal thing, the art is. And yet there's nothing that looks like a panda until the 20th century, which is just remarkable. What it really suggests to me quite strongly is that if the Chinese knew about it, it was a very local level. Well, they surely would have known about it. So the boundaries between human settlements in, say, Sichuan and pandas, which would have moved much higher, so steering well clear of humans, they wouldn't interact a lot, but they would have done a bit, but just no cultural significance of the panda in China's imperial past.
So let's talk about the first Westerner to discover the panda, see a panda. And this is a French missionary.
Yeah, French missionary, Armand David. Great guy. He's a sort of hero. Someone who's not really received the proper credit for his work. Obviously a fascinating character. So he was out there, a Catholic missionary from... He was born in the Pyrenees, but had this calling and had decided he was going to go to China to convert... the Chinese, this nation ripe for conversion. But he had a massive interest in natural history and went on three big expeditions during his sort of several years in China, and one at first into Mongolia, and the second was where he discovered the giant panda. I mean, he's more famously known for discovering the deer, which carries his name, Père David's deer, and that's a lovely story in itself, but... the panda, not strangely, it's not quite so well known as that it's one of his, but possibly because it didn't take his name as so many of the other things he described did. So there are a lot of, he was mainly a botanist, I'd say, and you know, Buddleia Davidi and Clematis Davidi and Armandii and all these things that we just see every day here in our gardens. They're all brought back from his travels.
So at what point, I mean, you say there's no real idea of pandas till the 20th century. At what point does the panda gain some traction, I suppose?
Well, so he discovered these couple of specimens, or his hunters shot a couple and brought them to him. He was stationed in a church, Catholic mission up in the mountains in Sichuan. And he sent them back to Paris. They got described and then written up into a monograph in the 1870s. And... then there was quite considerable interest in Paris and in London about this new creature. You know, it's a big, what David thought was a bear, and even then, I suppose, we thought we'd discovered most big mammals, and here was a big mammal that no one had even seen before, and as he described it, you know, one of the most beautiful creatures known to science. And... So it did get a lot of interest, and through the late 19th century, then there was quite a lot of interest in getting more specimens and describing them, particularly in Britain. And really, then I suppose from the early 20th century, it kind of became a real target for explorers, particularly at first to go and see, and then to go and shoot. And it sort of thwarted these explorers in their aims. They just couldn't even see the thing, so that gave this extra kind of mystery and an allure, and got everyone even more interested in it. Yeah.
Well, you say that, you know, that it became a target, but we are talking about sort of people that were out to study natural history, not necessarily big game hunters, and it always seems like weird at this distance that was the sort of, you know, the Victorian naturalist method was to study things by going out and shooting a few of them.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's one of the very extraordinary things that you can do through looking at the panda over the course of 140 years is see this extraordinary change in the way that we look at, obviously, pandas, but it's just a symbolic for how we look at animals, so that it appears not really to have occurred to anyone to collect a live panda until the 1930s, which is then, you know, it's a good 70 years after, 70 years after their, 60 or 70 years after the discovery, which is, you know, so the mission was then just to go and shoot them for the first bit, to get specimens, yeah.
You're listening to Little Atoms with Neil Denny, me, Padraig Reedy, and our guest Henry Nichols, author of Way of the Panda. I'm going to throw in the stupid question now. You'd mentioned earlier that Père David thought pandas are bears. They're definitely bears, aren't they?
They're definitely bears, yeah. They're a special kind of bear, but they're a bear. So in this whole... It's a fascinating debate. I deal with one of the chapters. It's... has to be one of the most extraordinary long-running stories in the history of taxonomy. So when he sent back his specimen, he sort of suggested to his urban expert back in Paris that he thought it was a bear. He even gave it a name, Ursus melanolucus, black and white bear. And the guy in Paris, I'm reading into it here, but you know, others have talked about the tensions between provincial and the centralised naturalists, and they did not like being told what they considered to be their own job, so being told what the species was. And I just get the sense that the French naturalists back in Paris looked for a different explanation. Now, they had the type specimen of the red panda. In Paris, so it was collected in the 1830s and described by Cuvier. So they had this reference point, and there are very striking similarities between the giant panda and the red panda, and these seem to have swayed. So in that first description, then he gives it this different name, and it's described as a relative of the red panda, and that is in fact how it gets the name panda, which... Mm-hmm. So up until that point, it was called other things, black and white bear or particoloured bear, which isn't quite so sexy. So it only gets this name because of this misidentification, which I think is one of these twists of history, because it's quite a cool name, panda. It's just a good word. It's got some good letters in it. It's as simple as that. And
giant panda in itself,
giant panda,
is pretty cool.
Even better. Mm. So then the red one then also became known as the lesser panda to distinguish it from this one.
Which is a bit rubbish.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's very, very cute, but it... yeah.
But basically, all this adds again to the essential mystique, which seems central to our perception.
What
of pandas.
Is it? Yeah, definitely.
And now I think most people would be very familiar with the WWF logo, which has, again, which is obviously a panda in a green circle. Is there some sense where the iconic nature of the panda came first, or did it come because the WWF used it as the symbol for all endangered animals everywhere?
I think the conservation, sort of the meaning... When I look at that logo, I've actually started thinking about what do I actually think when I look at that logo? And I don't actually think most people look at it and think pandas. Mm-hmm. Even if they're looking at what is clearly a panda, what they think is something global, it's a bit abstract, and it's a bit benevolent, and they know it means global conservation. And so, yeah, the panda is completely abstracted in that image and symbolic, obviously. So I think that's rather crucial, that moment, in adding this kind of conservation message to the panda story. But it was definitely an icon before then, but it didn't quite have that. I mean, I suppose the conservation movement was really too young in the decades before that for it to have assumed that kind of meaning, but it, you know, it's a crucial moment in how we now see pandas, that image and just how successful it has been.
You mentioned before that it took, you know, it was about 70 years from the discovery before people really started in earnest to want to capture live pandas to take abroad. And I'm going to sort of rush over that bit, and there's another great character, Ruth Harkness, people should look up, because we could have talked about her, who is one of the sort of pioneers of capturing pandas. But I want to bring us up to Chi Chi, who is the famous London Zoo panda, who is, like, you know, probably one of the if not the most famous panda ever. And we'll talk a little bit about Chi Chi's story, but I also want to bring in the other fact that people will think they know about pandas is that, you know, they're not really that interested in sex. And yeah. I wonder if this is perhaps where this myth comes from. So let's tell us about who Chi Chi was and what the how she ended up in London Zoo, first of all.
Well, she was born in Sichuan in 1957 and captured as a cub and eventually ended up in Peking Zoo. And it was there that an Austrian animal dealer, had sort of rocked up with three... I'm going to get it wrong, but basically a massive consignment of African mammals, really impressive, giraffes, hippos, rhinos, and in exchange he took away one panda. So what he was trying to do was sell it to Brookfield Zoo in Chicago. They had had the very first captive panda captured by the woman you just mentioned, Ruth Harkness, and they wanted a repeat performance. It had been so successful. So the word was on the street was they were prepared to offer $25,000, quite a lot of money in 1958, and he was trying to get it out, but this was 1958, and she got branded as communist goods, this panda. So the communist panda, the Americans wouldn't... There was a trade embargo up, so no American goods going to China, and not receiving any Chinese products, and this was one. So she ended up going on a sort of tour of Europe and ended up in London for 3 weeks, and London Zoo bought her with assistance from Granada TV. And she became a star there, lived for the next 14 years at London Zoo. She's probably the inspiration for the World Wildlife Fund logo, which was created 50 years ago in 1961. So I consider her to be the face of global conservation. But more famous for what happened in 1966. So she became fertile, and Desmond Morris, who was then curator of mammals, did something which is surprising to me to think, well, this was novel and this was something you shouldn't do, but this is the case. In 1960s, in zoos, it was not procedure to try and get your animals to breed. And Morris was quite passionate about breeding as much as anything from a welfare perspective, so to try and complete the animals' captive lifestyles as much as possible. Now, then the only other panda in captivity outside China or North Korea was in Moscow, which was hardly any better. So there's this crazy plan hatched to, and it happened to be a male called Anan, and a crazy plan hatched to fly Chi Chi to Moscow Zoo, which... it had to get diplomatic clearance, you know, went to the Prime Minister's office. And when Morris went there on a sort of recce in early 66, they basically was tracked by the KGB. They just thought, well, he's obviously spying. No nutter would come up with this plan to breed pandas. That's just stupid. So this whole thing was kind of coated in farce, really. But it was although China had succeeded by that point in breeding pandas in captivity, the first captive panda born in 63 in Peking Zoo, it had not received the attention that this affair did. It was, you know, it's just a massive global interest in this. And particularly, I think, in the English-speaking world, obviously, and with these Cold War tensions between the Soviet Union and Britain, there was a lot of opportunity for satire. And the pandas didn't breed very famously, so it was a massive flop, and literally and the pandas, I don't think, then ever recovered or have even a hope of recovering any kind of reputation. Pandas. It was all over by that point. And the satire that followed it was I think, quite important too in setting the panda up as this comedic figure that we can all poke fun at.
So there's also an idea that the pandas, like, almost like a sort of evolutionary dead end. Like, it's a bit pointless because they don't like sex, so, like, you know, they shouldn't really have happened or something.
Yeah. It's unbelievably, you know, common that. I found it very frustrating. Someone would say, what are you working on? I say, well, I'm working on pandas. And then you get this, well, it's an evolutionary stupid waste of space. And I try, in as rational a fashion as possible, to talk about the science that demonstrates that that is not the case. If you're in any doubt about it, you just have to consider that the panda we know has been around in pretty much its current form for about 20 million years, which is approximately 20 million years longer than modern humans. So, you know, I just struggle to see this evolutionary dead end argument. But I argue it, and then it just doesn't do anything. I mean, it just get the same thing again, but it's still a rubbish animal. So the only thing I thought, in fact, to sort of demonstrate that would be if I could demonstrate within the history of the panda a moment where this idea appears. And I think it clearly does in the 1960s. Before that, people are adoring of pandas in the way they are now, but you get none of these silly jokes. The occasional one about the size of the male's penis, but no, that's about it. Then it just goes crazy from the 60s onwards, and that idea, particularly in the English-speaking world, which is why I think it's tied to the Chi-Chi Anan affair. You know, it's a very common idea in Britain and in America, and then it's just infective, and it's kind of gone global, that idea now.
We should say that a huge aspect of the book is basically you sort of parallel the rise of the panda as, you know, as this popular animal, as with the, you know, the rise of China as a world power. I mean, we're out of time, so we're not really going to get a chance to talk about that. But could you just quickly finish off by telling us what is the state of conservation at the moment? I mean, what's going on in China in terms of, like, conserving the panda numbers?
Well, devastated forests in the 70s and 80s have really fragmented the habitat, so that's pretty desperate. And, of course, a population of 1.4 billion people with this incredibly rapid rise in living standards is placing enormous pressures on all wildlife in China. And the panda is no exception. But, of course, it does have a lot of money and state backing. So there are a lot of good signs about the panda, and I just sort of see that what happens with the panda is, it's worth following what China does to the panda, because I think it's the species that brings the whole of China's green credentials along with it. So we can assess how well or how seriously China is taking this very difficult balancing act they've got by looking at how well they do with pandas.
Well, thank you very much, Henry Nichols. Henry's book, The Way of the Panda, is out right now in all good bookshops and some bad ones. And we'll be back next week.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.